to ask Richard Dalton if he would lead off on the subject of the Arab Revolution's will democracy prevail.
Like other speakers, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to start by redefining the question. It's the Arab Spring, will it come true, or is it too good to be true? And my answer is, in brief, that it will come true, and that we are looking at the end of an era of authoritarian governments, but it'll come true via a very tortuous and difficult process in many of the states we're looking at. In fact, I rather like an expression used by Shadi Hamad of the Brookings Institute the other day at Chatham House, when he mentioned the end of stability, meaning that the barriers of fear had largely come down, that change would happen, it was merely a matter of time. In thinking about what will follow, of course, we do have the definition problem, which you mentioned, Michael. I should state mine. Using an undemanding definition of democracy, you could think of a gradual empowering of people to have a voice in their political institutions. So, yes, definitely, that's on its way. Using an ambitious one, gradual emergence of equal rights and equal shares in formal political power exercised through the right to vote. Yes, I think that is coming as well. But then, of course, there's the idealistic definition, government of the people, by the people, for the people. I'm not sanguine about that. Indeed, it has always been an exaggeration, hasn't it? And given the power of vested interests, I think it's too much to expect in most countries, including those in the Middle East. So why has it kicked off now? Well, first, the gulf between myths, ideas, and beliefs, and the social, economic, and political realities they profess to explain. That's not my phrase. It's one from an American historian of Libya about the 1st September revolution in Libya in 1969 and why people are up in arms today. Ronald Bruce St. John is his name. He also used a reference to failure to shift the blame for the country's problems from himself, meaning Gaddafi, and the ideology in the Green Book, to a government he has long dominated and belatedly recognized as corrupt and inefficient. Libya again, but of general application. Then, of course, we all know about youth and its discontents, the communications revolution, and the different degree of awareness achieved in the last 10 years of the delay in political modernization in the Arab world. You can call this the Al Jazeera factor, the fact that there's even more emigrants from the Arab world in our societies, regularly visiting home, regularly communicating with home, what they could have should their societies develop better. And then finally, on why it's all happening now, this collapse in so many states of the barrier of fear. Now, I don't believe that even Saudi Arabia can neutralize all those reasons for challenge to the existing autocratic regimes of the Arab world. And I don't see any of those six reasons as temporary. I think they're all behind a sustaining and sustainable challenge to the status quo. So what next? I believe that the leaderships, the old ones and the new ones, will be experimenting. They're trying preemptive concessions, they're trying spreading economic benefits to buy people off. I think there's a certain embarrassment arising in the Arab world now at repression. It's not quite so easy and fashionable to do because of the fact that the world is watching, amongst other things. But I think in responding, the new leaderships will proceed pragmatically. They're not going to try and impose a functioning, institutionalized ideological system, whether it's a secularly conceived one or an Islamic conceived one or a fully democratic one. They're going to go step by step. And, of course, one of the reasons they're going to go step by step is that they're contending with serious adversity. I mean, the list is tremendous. Rising expectations, which is going to be difficult, as difficult for the new governments as it has been for the old. the new levels of popular mobilization, the migration of skilled labor and capital increase as a response to disorder, the challenges of foreign policy that are going to arise over the next few years. Anyone for war between Israel and Lebanon, for example, the challenge of Iran. Then there's the influence of others' interests in what happens in individual countries, the Saudi interest in what happens in Bahrain, the Israeli interest in what happens in Egypt, the United States, Israeli interest in what happens in Syria, the Iranian interest in what happens in Syria. These are all potentially cross-currents. And then also amongst the adversities which the new governments are going to have to contend with, there's the weak work ethic in so many of the countries that we're looking at, particularly the Gulf, a preference for ingrained family and client links. I mean, corruption is not just a function of governments who find it convenient to bind elites to them. It's also in there as a byproduct of way society has come to think is right. Semi-independent judiciaries. How do you proceed to establish a rule of law without a cadre of judges? I very much remember a plea to Tony Blair when he was working on African governance from the president of Senegal, who was one of those who was really working to build a new Africa. And he said, where do I get judges from who can actually be gutful enough to stand up against the big men in my society? So, if that's the pragmatic framework in which we're going to be operating, there are one or two major choices which the new governments have to make. And here we start getting into an area where we can only guess country by country, and we've not got time to do so today. But will they be going for an association of citizens and their institutions as the model, or will they be thinking in terms of traditional dominance of the state? Will they be working primarily in the interests of the elites or of a conception of the people as a whole? How much importance will they attach to ideas of legitimacy? Or are they going to go down the route of preparing force once debate gets to a point where they regard it as unmanageable? Then will they plump for a new version, a rather watered-down version of the security states that are there at present? Or will they be committed to genuine pluralism? And finally, what place will they give to Islam? Now, different political scientists may have different versions, country by country, of how those choices are going to be made. But it's difficult territory in which to predict. Because, as you know, every state has a different history, it has a different starting point, and it's likely to have a different trajectory. So, finally, the outcomes, I think it's going to be an uneasy mixture, going back to the thought that it's going to be a pragmatic rather than an ideological response to events. It's going to be an uneasy mixture. We're going to look to a period of change and reform in which there will be a certain amount of instability. There will even be periods of regression when, for example, as in Bahrain, reform initiatives fail and a stark minimum requirement for order emerges. Then there are, of course, very serious risks that the process may even stop in some countries, whether as a result of elite interests asserting themselves, and within that, a middle-class preference for order over unstable progress. We may even find democratic procedures used to abridge democracy. Has happened, hasn't it? Remember the effect of economic hardship on democratic societies. 1930s was the age of dictators in Europe and Latin America. And, of course, there's the military that can intervene if it feels that matters are going too far, as in Brazil and Turkey in their recent history. And finally, under risks, contagion from other states. We've seen it operating in the first few months in a positive manner, but it can also operate in a negative manner and boost repression. But where will we end up? I think Arab states are on the path trodden by Asian, African and European and Latin American countries before them. They will get to, go back to my definitions, equality of rights, an equal share in formal political power through the right to vote, with associated representative and accountable government, but they will do so at different speeds and with different amounts of hard struggle. And the analogy I like is that if we think of liberation in the British Empire, I was taught that after Indian independence in 1947, it became inevitable, or at least more and more likely. After Ghana in 1956, it was indeed inevitable, and it was accelerating. The last major territories to take their seats in the UN were Fiji in 1970 and Zimbabwe, I think, in 1980. So there we have a large group of states previously ruled by the UK with decent constitutions and high hopes. And if the Arab Spring does its work over a similar 20 to 30 years in some 18 states, wouldn't we be delighted? Actually, I think it could well happen in most of them rather faster, if not at an Eastern European velocity. Credit, of course, would be to their peoples, but there are two actions by their friends and partners, like the UK and the EU, which would be useful and politic in our overseas relations, and of course essential for our self-respect, namely one, consistent advocacy of democracy and human rights, and two, generous responses to requests to share our expertise with civil society and government. Thank you.
First of all, thank you very much for having me here. Unlike Ambassador Dalton, I'll actually avoid answering the question because I don't know. What I will do, however, is draw your attention to what I think are six points that I think are extremely important or were extremely important in leading to the revolts. I would not like to use the word revolutions, but revolts that we have seen in a number of countries, including mine, Egypt, and that I think the same factors will play important factors or important roles in the future. I think it's very presumptuous if I or anybody else say what will happen, but I think if we analyze or look at least at these six factors, we might get a better view of how can we envisage these futures. The first factor is the changes in the middle classes across the region, and specifically in the countries with the largest demographics. And by these, I mean mainly Egypt, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Syria, and Iraq. If you look at the composition of the middle class in these countries, and I admit I know about Egypt quite well, but not very well about the others, obviously. But if you look at the composition of the middle class at the mid-20th century, roughly when the monarchies of the Arab world fell, and before the rise of Arab nationalism and then the wave of Islamism after that, the middle class at that time was predominantly composed of private sector employees and to a very large extent people involved with the agriculture industry throughout these economies I refer to. What happened over the 50 years after that is a massive wave of industrialization throughout these countries. Again, Egypt is a good example. And basically that meant that the middle class, number one, unlike what many observers say, did not shrink, it actually expanded. And number two, their economic interests became very much entangled with the more diversified economies. The purely agricultural societies of the 1920s and 30s in Egypt, Iraq, whatever, increasingly became industrialized. We have seen after that the growth of services. And that meant that the middle classes' economic attachment to the country has increased. They had more stake in the game, if you'd like. That's very important because I think it is a stability factor. If you have a stake in the game, you don't want to burn things. You don't want to have too much chaos. And I believe that also was one of the key reasons why in places such as Egypt, we have not seen relatively, we have not seen chaos, we have seen a relatively peaceful change. So the composition of the middle class, really, what happened to that middle class over the past 50 years, I think is a very important point, especially that in almost all of these countries, over the past 10 or 15 years, we have seen a massive rise of wealth. Wealth as in a merger, if you'd like, a blur between financial powers and the regimes. That started more or less to create some sort of a friction also with these middle classes, expanding middle classes with their economic interests in the country. So the aspirations and the sorrows, if you'd like, of these major classes, major segments of middle classes in these huge countries is a very important point to look at. The second point I want to draw your attention to is the idea of legitimacy in these countries. Egypt, for example, has never really had proper elections at all. We always say that in Egypt, at least, that the pharaoh is the semi-god. 5,000 years ago, that was part of our theology. Over the past few decades, it was part of our culture. I think the main basis of legitimacy in many Middle Eastern countries is not really proper elections, but rather consent, that the farmer, the laborer, the head of the family, a middle class family, really consent to that leader. They are okay with Nasser ruling, with Gaddafi ruling, with the Saudi family ruling. They are not hostile to that. So consent has for many years, I think for hundreds of years, been the basis of legitimacy, certainly for one of the most, in my view, exciting experiments of ruling in the Middle East, which is Nasser. Nasser has never, ever had a proper elections. Actually, I learned that partly from Dr. Rogan's book. He gave fantastic examples, I think. But certainly he had the consent of the people. He had legitimacy. That consent, I argue, has been withdrawn in almost every single country in the Arab world, and certainly in Egypt over the past 30 or 40 years, gradually. Not necessarily in one moment, but gradually. And I think when you withdraw the consent, the pillars that supposedly these regimes are held upon disappear, and therefore they put different pillars. And in the case of Egypt, certainly in the case of Iraq and Libya as well, and I would argue in many places in the Gulf as well, security, the security apparatus, the mukhabarat, the intelligence services, coercion, fear, became these pillars of ruling. And I think there's a huge difference between consent versus fear. So the legitimacy is a very important point. And so far, we do not have any basis of legitimacy in a place like Egypt, for example. So what would be the legitimacy, I think, is a point that we need to think about. The third point is institutions. And I think this is a tricky one because I've had the chance to meet President Mubarak at one point in time, actually, in a gathering. And a point he kept repeating all the time is, but Egypt is a country of institutions. We have the constitution, we have the parliament, we have the presidency. And I argue that, and here I would limit my argument to Egypt, which is the one I know quite well. I would not presume to talk about other countries. Every single institution in Egypt has failed. The parliament is certainly not democratic. The presidency have weakened dramatically from the days of Nasser and how it was a very vibrant institution over the past 30 years. The government was effectively a mere tool in the hands of the ruling party and the president. And even the ruling party was effectively controlled by a very tiny, small cadre of elite. At its head was the president's own son. So if you have a country, again, such as Egypt, with 83 million people, more than 6,000 years of history, without real institutions, I think that's a very vacuous society. Today, that's a danger as well, because if as an Egyptian now, if Egyptians want to build a country that has extremely weak institutions, that's a major challenge. So how would the different institutions in these countries develop? Do they have chances to really evolve into something viable or not? I think an area that needs to be studied. The fourth point I want to draw attention to is national project. And my editor actually at Yale once told me, Tarek, this is a very, very poor English, really, because I'm translating literally from Arabic. So excuse me. I don't know if there's a better word for a mashru al-qawmi, national project. But the idea basically was that there are many societies in the Middle East. Egypt is certainly one of them. The Levant in general is certainly one of them. That has always had history in their psyche. They always thought of themselves as heirs to civilizations. And they always wanted to be inspired by something. And I think this is actually one of the main reasons why Nasser, despite successive failures, until today retains that nostalgia, that he came or put forward this very ambitious national project. We did not have, we as Arabs in general, did not have really any national project over the past 30 or 40 years at all. We had one before that, which effectively failed, Arab nationalism, but at least there was one. Before that, there was a very interesting one, which is Arab liberalism in the end of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. It also failed, in my view, but there was one. Now there isn't. And the question is, are we going to see new national projects emerging out of the Middle East or not? And if so, are they going to be reincarnations of modernism, Arab nationalism, or new ones? So far, I don't think we're even seeing any roots for these, but another area to look at. Last point. Demographics. You're talking about basically 320 million people, of which 80% are under 35 years old. I can talk about that a lot, but I'll stop here because there's lots of issues here. But effectively, super young population.
It's critical. Time always crawls for you and flies for us at the podium. The nice thing about being the third speaker in a panel like this is that when I have two co-panelists with whom I agree so much, I find many of the points that I had wanted to make have already been covered. And so I'll take less time to leave you more time for the exchange and questions. I totally share the arguments that have been put forward. I think we've seen in the course of the first 3 months of 2011 the kind of historical changes that we have not witnessed in the region since 1952. If anything, though, and perhaps it reflects the speed of modern media, it's so much faster. What happened in the Egyptian Revolution of 1952 transformed the region, no doubt. But it took years for that to really begin to show itself. In the course of 3 months, the success of the Tunisian Revolution has really made its impact felt on every single country of the region, from North Africa through the Middle East to the Arabian Peninsula. It's very hard to point to a country where it hasn't, where there hasn't been some demonstration, where there hasn't been some sort of public action. What is striking to me as a longtime observer of Arab history is how an idea we had discredited, Arabism or Arab nationalism, seems to have taken on a new political significance, because what Arabs do in one part of the Arab world influences Arabs across the Arab world more than anything anybody else does. The Arabs watched with great fascination as communist regimes in Eastern Europe fell in a rather sweeping movement like we're witnessing in the Arab world today. But it didn't actually make them want to get up and do the same thing. Tunisia's success so inspired other Arabs, and it gave them strategies and a language to harness in their own grievances with their own political problems that have made a kind of kit that they've all applied. So we see the slogans. I mean, not catchy slogans. Ash-Sha'b yurid isqat an-nizam doesn't even rhyme. But it means the people want the fall of the regime. And that was really a common demand across the board. It's what the kids in Dar'a were spraying on the walls when they were arrested 2 weeks ago by the authorities that sparked the current trouble in Syria. It's what they said in Bahrain. It's what they said in Jordan and Wizar al-Dakhili roundabout. So it's a language that emerged from Tunisia. The idea that you liberate a central part of your city. It was Avenue Bourguiba for the Tunisians, Tahrir Square for the Egyptians, Pearl Square in Manama. Again, Wizar al-Dakhili roundabout in Amman. Try and put some tents up and liberate the territory in the name of a new way of doing politics. And, of course, the use of Facebook and Twitter to mobilize people. So we see Arabs looking at other Arabs, and it's generating results. But also, Arab leaders are looking at other Arab leaders, and they're learning from the experiences of what's failed for them. Anybody who watched Ben Ali or Mubarak handle their respective crises didn't want to go down the same route they did, or else they were going to be taking Umrah a little earlier than they'd intended and go visit Hijaz in Saudi Arabia. So we've seen a wide range of responses by regimes that are admittedly autocratic and don't really want to see themselves out of business. And if we come to the question we're posed, will democracy prevail? I think what we can see now after 3 months is a way of grouping the different experiences of Arab countries to see that there's going to be a variegated answer to that question. And my answer would be it's going to prevail to a varying degree more or less across the region. But being an optimist like my fellow panelists, I would argue that the highest standard of political freedoms any one Arab country achieves is going to serve as the benchmark that everyone else is going to measure their country by. And I think that the process that had started in 2011, this incredible revolutionary year, is going to continue for the months to come and probably for the years to come, as those countries that don't achieve everything they'd hoped for in 2011 will continue the struggle. Maybe they'll be beaten down and have to fight again. But the patterns that I see emerging, I think we can identify four. Yes, I gave four here. And at the top of the list, the ones that I think had the highest chance of success, and actually for some of the reasons that Tariq has outlined, would be Egypt and Tunisia. I'm actually more sanguine about the institutions in these countries. I think that they are what give Egypt and Tunisia the basis on which to make a meaningful transition to democracy. I see the judges in Egypt, and correct me if I'm wrong, as having really struggled to try and assert their independence against a very strong executive. And now that the executive is gone, I will expect them to play a very important part in bringing a rule of law to Egypt. I think that the press in Egypt is a great asset. It's been struggling for a long time to be a critical and free press. It's taken a lot of censorship laws to contain them. They're already demonstrating their part in contributing. The parliament, it's true, has been a failed institution, but change the people in parliament and let's see what happens. Even the executive who gets to run for president and what will emerge in Egypt, and similarly in Tunisia, will be very telling. Tunisia, departing a little bit from Egypt, the debates there seem to be about moving to a parliamentary system. They've had their big men in presidency between Bourguiba and Ben Ali, and they'd like to have a change of system. So maybe Westminster's got something to offer for Tunisia. But look to those two countries to be the leaders, as they have already proved in 2011. Secondly, you're going to be the states of repression. And here I've got three outstanding examples, Algeria, Syria, and Bahrain. These are the countries that have decided to meet protest movements with overwhelming force. In Algeria, basically, the few times they've tried to have demonstrations, the security forces so outnumbered the demonstrators, they've given it up. And people are saying that the recent experience of political violence in Algeria makes demonstrators wary of getting too pushy with the state. But keep an eye on Algeria. I don't think it's stable. Syria is unfolding now. Bahrain, of course, we've seen the tragic results. The one thing those two countries have in common is that the rest of the Arab world sees them as windows of opportunity for Iran to be extending its influence in the region and makes them both very volatile, very, very nervous. But I think here the concern of other Arab states means that there could be interventions that do not go the way of advancing the aims of the democracy activists. And I think that we might see that it takes a very high price for democracy to prevail in the short run in those countries. The third, I would class as the monarchies that enjoy more legitimacy than their governments. And here it's Morocco, it's Jordan, to some degree it's Saudi Arabia, though they don't really quite fit. But these are countries that can try and put a bit of distance between themselves and demonstrations by putting the blame on their governments and being the good king. They're absolute monarchs. So you could throw Oman into this category too. Oman, my God, the man is Sultan, Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, Minister of the Economy, and Minister of Defense. If you want to define absolutism, Oman's a good way to do it. But each of these countries, to stave off revolution, are already showing a willingness to escalate evolution, and to try and move towards an increasingly constitutional form of monarchy. We wish them well. The really worrisome cases are the weak states. And here I look at Yemen, Libya, the Sudan, the Palestinian Authority, as examples of states where we've already seen very strong movements in Yemen and in Libya, rather weak ones in Sudan and the Palestinian Authority. But when the strong leader is toppled, they have so undermined the states that they rule that it's hard to know what will follow. And here the real risk of failed states makes them great risk of collapse, and where internecine strife might in fact lead to trouble spots rather than promising results in the revolutionary year of 2011. So what I see in conclusion is very different patterns across the region, which suggest very different results for their democracy movements. Democracy is to prevail in some parts, but there's a risk of real trouble in others. I think it'll take vigilance both by fellow Arab states. Rather disappointed to see the Arab League turn to NATO or the West to save their problems in Libya. I hope the Arab League and the Arab states play a more active role in assisting the transition. But also I think it'll take a disinterested international community, or international communities whose interest in stable oil prices will give them means to try and moderate trouble, so that we can see the excitement of 2011 not degenerate or disintegrate into crisis. Thank you.